Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. We were at All Together Now on Friday. Future Proof was on stage with a bunch of other acts from Go Louds, the Go Loud group, which is podcasts and radio shows, as I'm sure you're aware if you listen to this. We had a great old time. The stage looked fantastic. There's some good stuff around socially. If you're on Instagram and you follow News Talk, you'll see a picture of me eating some very dodgy food because we had Chef Ivan Varian and Dr. Ruth Freeman, who I'm sure you're familiar with, talking about the science of food on stage. It was great old fun. I very much enjoyed meeting people who randomly came up to me and said, really enjoyed the program. Thank you so much. I enjoyed even more the random people I met who said, you don't look 50. They were great. So to all the people who dropped their jaw, yes, thank you. I very much needed that weekend, very much. I was feeling very old. So you know who you are. Okay, so on this week's podcast, we're talking about the solar eclipse. So at time of recording, we are 5 days away from the return of a full solar eclipse. And 11 years ago, I was lucky enough to get in a plane with Professor Peter Gallagher, who was then with Trinity College Dublin, and we jumped into a Air Corps plane and flew into what's called the path of totality. That's the direct line of sight to the solar eclipse. We opened up the window and took some photographs. There's a link to that piece in the description of this podcast. You can actually listen to the first time we went out. But Peter Gallagher and his team, Laura Hayes, who you know from the news round, they are going back into the skies to get another shot at this and take some photographs of the solar eclipse. We're going to be talking about that on this week's pod. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, and all of those comments that you've sent from last week are at the end of the show. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. It is silly season, but some great stories. We have Dr. John Regan from Maynooth University and from DICE, Dr. Laura Hayes, assistant professor there, who's, as I say, going on that flight. You're both very welcome. Laura, our first story has to do with crashing into the moon.
It does indeed. So this is actually a story that a spent SpaceX Falcon 9 upper stage crashed into the moon of Wednesday morning of this week. And this crashed into the moon around 19 months after its launch. So this is a piece of the Falcon 9 that doesn't come back to Earth. It's not that part of the rocket. It's the part they kind of get rid of. And usually this part of the rocket kind of comes back to Earth and burns up in Earth's atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
However, this was a Falcon 9 that was going to launch two pieces of equipment to the moon. So this upper part was kind of out in space and left on its own devices and has now crashed into the moon.
So it sort of swung around the moon, was pulled in by the gravity, or it went straight out?
Yeah, basically. So it's kind of floating in space, just kind of didn't necessarily know where it was going to go. And it took 19 months and it eventually crashed into the moon. So kind of a combination of gravity of the sun and the moon and basically crashed in.
Is that okay?
This is where this whole story comes from. You're like, why does this matter? Right? Did it hurt anyone on the moon? It's just a piece of old space junk. And I guess this is where it comes from is we're now kind of living in this new space age of people. This is also a commercial flight that was flying commercial pieces of equipment to the moon. To
right.
Commercial moon landers or moon rovers. And so it's a thing of space debris, right? So this is a massive piece of equipment. You know, it's kind of the size of a school bus, crashed into the moon at over 8,000 kilometers an hour.
Is it that big?
Yeah. These are massive. Big. Yeah. And it's going to crash into the moon, right? So nobody has actually seen it yet. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is going to image it in the next few days, which would be kind of cool. So we're thinking it's a crater, you know, 20, 30 meters across. So absolutely massive. And there has been some observations with the European Southern Observatory Very Large Telescope, which has seen kind of this dust has flown up into space as caused by this piece of debris.
You're the space and physics lady. This won't nudge the moon or anything. Because, like, this is a big piece.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going, like, slowly.
No, it was not going slowly.
How fast was this thing going?
Yeah, no, it was going 8,000 kilometres an hour. So that's almost like 2.4 kilometres a second, right? Super fast. The moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So, I mean, in one sense, you know, NASA have flown things artificially into the moon before to see what happens, right? From seismic point of view or to see what crater point of view thing is. I mean, the moon is big. This thing is big, but, you know, it's going to cause a new crater. And it's interesting, maybe from a science point of view, that we know how large this thing was. We know how fast it was traveling, and maybe we can do some crater science for understanding exactly, you know, how this was developed. Now, the problem is...
So just in terms of international bodies, are they like... Because, like, obviously this is Musk and his sort of work, you know, and it is the space debris flying around the Earth, but, like, actually having rubbish from Musk on the moon actually makes me a bit sick.
Yeah, and of course, we love to finger wag at SpaceX, right? But at the moment, there is no real, you know, policy against this. And this is something that maybe needs to come into the conversation. There is policy about things, you know, in Earth orbit that you need to kind of take care of, but not for things that go further. And now that we're thinking about going back to the moon and having moon bases, you don't want a big massive thing landing on the moon on your moon base that costs billions of dollars, right? So I think this kind of opens up the questions of what do we do now, right, as a global policy for understanding, you know, what do we do with our junk in space?
You're not quite going into space, but you are on a very special mission. We're going to be talking about this with Peter in a bit. But tell me a little bit about how you're feeling about this this flight. You're going to fly into the path of the eclipse on a military aircraft.
Yes.
How excited are you about it?
I'm extremely excited, right? So next Wednesday on the 12th, we have a solar eclipse. It's going to be a partial in Ireland. But the totality of the eclipse, where the moon will be completely covering the sun, will actually be over the Atlantic Ocean, kind of in the Irish Economic Zone. So we're going to fly into this path of totality. And we're going to fly in an Irish Air Corps plane. We're going to use a specialized piece of equipment from our Italian colleagues and take an image of the eclipse. So super exciting mission campaign that we're going to do. So I am, of course, pumped. We're not going to space, but we're going over the Atlantic.
That's very cool. Yeah. We're going to hear more about that mission in a bit. But our second story, John, has to do with social media.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I suppose, you know, with my honesty hat on, I have kids that are of a social media age or coming into it. So this story grabbed my attention. Most of the things we read or get thrown at us about social media is the adverse mental effects. Okay.
Yeah.
So this one's a little bit different. It's looking at the adverse academic effects of social media. What they did was, it's a longitudinal study. What a longitudinal study means is that they look at a cohort of people, in this case, children, over a period of time. Okay. And this case was about 4, 5, 6 years. And they took 5,000 students in Northern Italy. And what they looked at is their relative scores in these grading tests in mathematics, Italian, and English over a period of 4, 5, 6 years. Mm-hmm. And they weighted that against when they first interacted or first had a social media account. Okay. And they kind of, you can't decouple that from having a smartphone. Well, you can, but it's very hard and it could be meaningless. So basically, they're kind of the same thing. So smartphone, social media account, 5,000 children, scores over 4 or 5 years.
We often complain about the power of a particular study saying, you know, you can't really tell much if you ask 100 people questions about themselves. But that's a reasonable number of kids, and it's a reasonable amount of time to study something, to have something, that would give you useful information.
Yeah, absolutely. And I looked at this study, and I was kind of... As a parent with social media in my head, I did look at it in a kind of like, okay, I wonder what holes are in the study. You know, is there any kind of glimmer of light I can get out of this? And it's tricky, to be honest. It's tricky to get the glimmer out of it.
So what does it say?
The headline is, the earlier you start using social media, the worse your academic performance. And it does take a hit. Obviously, they have a grading system in Italy, but I kind of reverse that back to just put it to ages, which are better for us. So they looked at kids who started a social media account at age 10, 11, 12, 13. And they looked at the scores then at age 14. So the late adopters are people who take a social media account at 13 or over. Mm. Not so many of them.
Yeah.
Most of them are kind of 11, 12. But they looked from 10 up. And if you have a social media account from age 10, let's say, your scores are down, full stop. If you open a social media account at age 11, they're down, not as bad, but they're down. If you open a social media account at age 12, they're down as well, not as bad as the 10 as 11, but they're down again. They accounted, of course, for the socioeconomic effects as well. So that's obviously a huge factor in anybody's education. The social media impact is around a third of that. So let's say your scores go down by half, for example. No, it's not like that.
Yeah.
If you are in from a disadvantaged area, there'll be a third of that half. So like a sixth from social media. So that's a big hit.
Yeah.
Like that's not nothing.
No.
It's like in terms of like the differential, it's 0.2 and it's 0.7. for a big socioeconomic factor. So it's not nothing. Now, that's if you're opening the account at age 10.
Yeah.
It's not as bad at 11 and 12, but it's not great either. And I guess the upside is delay as much as possible. That's kind of the only conclusion you can get from it. But what I would look at is the trend.
Yeah.
And the trend isn't great.
Yeah. And it is so difficult. I had this conversation with my son last night, you know, came home. He was supposed to be at tennis camp and he was like, no one was there. So he came home and he was playing, you know, playing video games and watching YouTube. And we had a big long chat about this is not, you know, what we're supposed to be doing with our time. And then he was like, well, I want to do something fun, Dad, do something fun. And it's quite hard as a parent, like when you just put on the challenge there to say, okay, let's do something fun. So we tried to make a Rube Goldberg machine and absolutely failed. They're very hard to do. Those videos where people, you know, one thing drops into another thing and it swings around, hits something else. Anyway, we tried to make it and we gave up halfway through. But I suppose at least it was in the doing. It was in the doing.
Right? I didn't take a lot of solace from reading this. I was hoping for a better result.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I think we just kind of go, this is generally the way the world is. And look, everybody else is doing it. But that's actually a really stupid approach because it is your child. And to just say, well, look, everyone else is doing it. Obviously, not everyone else is doing it. And this is their life. This is their childhood. You know, like it is insane to me to think about the amount of time, you know, kids are spending, you know, watching short form video in their spare time. Insane. Our third story, Laura, has to do with chewing gum.
It does indeed. And this is new research that has come out of the School of Dental Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And while it's a fascinating story, I think the headline runs slightly ahead of the evidence, right? So the headline said, chewing gum targets cancer-associated, you know, it can cure your cancer and things like this. However, this idea isn't that this chewing gum that they've developed attacks cancer cells or makes tumors disappear. Instead, it targets a virus and two types of bacteria associated with cancers in the mouth and throat. And this idea is that it could support development of more accessible and affordable treatments, right? So you have this idea that you have chewing gum, you can take it and it can kind of reduce some of this virus and bacteria that's associated with mouth and throat cancer. Now, this virus, as you might ask, it's called HPV, which we've maybe heard of before. It's extremely common. In most people, an infection causes no lasting problems, but certain types of HPV can remain in the body and interfere with natural systems and things like this. Bacteria in the mouth.
The cervical jab protects us against HPV. So if you get cervical cancer jab, both boys and girls, we can eradicate cervical cancer.
Exactly, yeah. And this has been shown to be hugely successful. And this is the thing that HPV is, I think they said, you know, one in every five adults can have the HPV virus. And hopefully in future years, that will be significantly reduced. So this is a thing, it attacks the HPV virus. And there's also two types of bacteria in your mouth that is associated with mouth and throat cancer. I'll spare everyone the names or everyone me trying to pronounce these names. But these high levels of bacteria have been associated with inflammation and tumour progression and basically poor outcomes of people who have head and neck cancer. So the idea is they developed this gum that doesn't attack the cancer itself, but it tries to remove this virus and these microbes. So how did they do this? They looked at this gum that contains a thing called frill. It's a protein from the lab bean, which is a cool name for a bean. And it kind of acts like this like flypaper, basically acts to attract the virus and stick it together. So instead of having this one HPV virus that can attack one cell, it basically allows all these HPV virus to kind of clump in one kind of area and then they can't attack one cell. So it's a really kind of nice idea. And they also looked at...
So do they then like converge on the actual chewing gum or do they just get swallowed?
Yeah, I guess they kind of get clumped together and they get attached to the gum or they can just kind of be in this large clump that then you swallow and it can kind of stay in your mouth for a long time. And as well as, you know, this HPV, they also had this antimicrobial protein that damages these two different types of bacteria, kind of pokes holes in their membrane, so then they can't be as damaging. Now, one thing to note is that they didn't actually make anyone chew gum here, right? So they actually looked at this gum and they took saliva from patients that have head and throat cancer, and they basically put this gum kind of in the saliva and tried to see how it would react.
Okay.
And it was really, really positive. They found that the bean gum actually extracted 93% of the HPV virus.
Wow.
Kind of available there. And they also found that 99% of the bacteria was actually attacked during this time. Wow. And this is, you know, really, really positive. And the good thing is that they actually found that the bacteria that it attacked, it didn't attack the good bacteria in your mouth, right? And that's really, really important.
That's amazing. So like, you know, potentially we might see some actual use to chewing gum at some point in the future. John, our final story has to do with AI.
Yeah, this one is much lighter. So this was a study published in the journal called Judgment and Decision Making. Loved the name of the journal. So they looked at AI short stories versus human short stories. So they had a sample of, 1,000 people or something like that, 1,500. And they gave them either a short story written by a human or a short story written by AI. And they'd tell them which one it was written by, but they'd mix it up. So they could give you an AI short story and tell you it was written by a human, okay, and vice versa. And then they asked the people just to rate the stories. And so I think we've all have heard of this before. And what the candidates came up at was that the AI stories were better quality by about 8% and more engaging by about 10%. So better overall. But the kicker also, they got a bump. If they told them the AI story is written by a human, then people rated it even higher, okay, into double digits at that point. So they were like, obviously, you know, this is just a bias that we all have, or most people have, I guess.
We want people, we don't want AI writing our story. So if we think that an AI has written it, we mark it low. And if we think a human's written it, we mark it higher. But even disallowing for that, people preferred AI stories.
I mean,
I think the type of stories that were written by the humans would really be important to me here. You know, there are, I mean, if you ever read Roald Dahl's short stories,
sure,
they are phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
If you compare those with AI generated short stories, they will win every time, in my opinion. But generic human written stories for a purpose of a science thing or things that are not rated very high or very original, I think people really overrate the capability of AI to do new and exciting and engaging things. General kind of, oh, that was a fine story. That's okay. They can do it, can figure out the structure, but actually being super creative and innovative and doing something brand new.
Yeah.
I do a lot of work with AI. I cannot get it to do that yet.
No, I agree. That's true. Now, it was published stories, so they were of a very high standard. But what it did say is the AI stories tend to be clearer and a little bit more accessible.
Yeah.
While what happens in like really good creative stories, like the one you're talking about, the characters have more depth.
Yeah.
And you have to pull that information out as the reader. And, you know, your general reader is like, no, I just want this to be clear.
Yeah.
that's the reality,
to be able to
right?
follow the story.
Exactly.
So, yeah, maybe the AI could critique the real story and just say, here's my way of work. We have AI editors and human story writers, John Regan and Laura Hayes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Okay, on the way, we're going to play you a piece from 11 years ago where I got on an Air Corps plane with some Irish researchers to fly into the direct path of a solar eclipse. Stay with us. Welcome back to our radio program here on News Talk. This is Future Proof. My name is Jonathan McCrae. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can WhatsApp us 087-1400-106. We get to those in the podcast. Now, this Wednesday, August 12th, the moon will pass directly between the Earth and the sun, creating a spectacular celestial display in parts of Europe. But unfortunately, the path of totality, where it's right, look, you're looking right down the barrel of this thing, doesn't happen in Ireland. But that's not going to stop Professor Peter Galler. He's a director of the Dunsink Observatory at the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies and he's adjunct professor at Trinity College Dublin. He'll be boarding an Irish Air Corps Airbus C-295 to try and answer the burning questions in solar science for the second time. He joins me now. Welcome back to the program, Peter. And listening to that piece that we heard just before the break brought me back to what an incredible experience it was for both of us to jump on that plane and fly on this plane into the path of totality.
That was a pretty crazy couple of weeks of getting prepared for that and then getting up in the aircraft and winging it, literally winging it to try and get some data. So yeah, it had its challenges, but eclipses are always challenging. You know,
yeah.
I've been doing these for 20 years maybe. The first one I went to was 1998. We went to Guadeloupe and I carried a huge computer across through Paris, Charles de Gaulle, got the equipment all set up in Guadeloupe. And what happens? The power cuts 2 minutes before totality.
No!
So ourselves, the Americans and the French, all the expeditions, nobody got any data whatsoever. So complete disaster. So we all cracked open beers and sat there and just looked at the eclipse and tried to deal with our depression. But that's the nature with eclipses. And especially when you've only got 2 minutes, things can go wrong.
Yeah, so it's a very short window. And like hearing in that piece, the captain literally on the back of a matchbox or something, figuring out the calculations to be able to figure out which way to go. There is a bit of, we've done all the planning, but not everything went according to plan. And, you know, hearing that piece, you'd imagine that we got the best data, we changed solar science forever. But just wondering, how did that last expedition go in terms of data?
Yeah, that the captain was Kevin O'Kelly, I remember. Yeah. And I remember just before totality, we're 10,000 feet, we got the cameras rolling, you're there, and we're in clouds. Yeah. You're like, God damn it, we got clouds. And I remember him on the back of a cigarette paper saying, I think there's a gap. I think we can get to it. Should I go for it? And I was like, well, the alternative is clouds. So we went into the gap, opened up the window, And we actually got some data.
Okay.
It wasn't the most beautiful data at all. There was a small amount of clouds, so the observations weren't as good as they could have been. And there was also some other issues. Like, it was our first time on an aircraft. We only got the cameras like 3 weeks beforehand. And then all of a sudden, we're on an aircraft trying to do science. And, you know, on the ground, it's hard enough. But when you're on an aircraft, you don't know your surrounds, a bit weird. And then we strapped the camera to the aircraft and it was shaking all over the place. It's a turboprop. So our images were really shaky.
Oh.
So we learned a lot. And that's kind of the process of science, right? Or, you know, anything. You kind of learn, you get things wrong and you learn from your mistakes.
Right.
So we got a couple of nice shots, though. Between the shaking, we got some nice shots, which were useful scientifically, but not as good as we wanted.
Right. And so we returned to the skies on Wednesday, or at least you returned to the skies with Laura, and you're going to try this again. What have we learned since that last mission about the sun? Because in the piece, we hear that this we've already heard this question of why is it hotter on the outside than it is on the surface of the moon? So in the atmosphere, it's hotter than it is on the surface. And it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
What have we learned since that piece was recorded?
Yeah, it's a really challenging one. It's almost embarrassing in solar physics. You know, we've known that the solar corona is really hot. It's over 1,000,000 degrees. We've known that since, 1930 or 1940 or something like that. And solar physicists still can't work the bloody thing out. But it just shows you the limitations of the observations that we take. We still can't get the right observations to work out what's going on. NASA have a spacecraft called Parker Solar Probe, which is this amazing thing that's flown really, really close to the sun.
Mm.
And it's seeing all these wobbling in the magnetic field. It's seeing things called switchbacks, which are little waves in the magnetic field. And we think that those waves are the things that are heating the solar corona. And they've seen these things and but it's still not definitive. And that's like a billion US dollar mission. And
hang on a second. I forgot about Solar Parker. Surely if we're flying the probe that close to the sun, the images that we get here on Earth are, you know, through the Earth's atmosphere. Sure, they're useless compared to, you know, right close-up images from the Solar Parker probe.
The thing about Parker is it's going so close that you can't actually have a camera. So there's no cameras on Parker looking straight at the sun. They're actually looking off at an angle. And so the cameras aren't taking the observations that you want. You can't just
look
straight.
Because it would just melt the sensor.
It just melts. I mean, the thing is that it's flying through the 1,000,000 degree plasma. So it's lucky that the spacecraft even survives. It's an amazing spacecraft, actually, because like it's going through 1,000,000 degree hot gas. And it's the fastest man-made object ever made. So it's just an incredible mission.
How fast does it go?
Oh, don't ask me questions like that. I'm not
very
sure.
Fast.
Very, very fast.
Okay. Okay, so actually we do need to be away from the sun. And also, presumably, we do need this eclipse to get really good imagery of the atmosphere of the sun. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, we always think, okay, spacecraft must be doing it better than what we can do on the ground. So, you know, there's Parker Solar Probe, and then the European Space Agency has a thing called Solar Orbiter. Now, Solar Orbiter is packed full of loads of pretty cameras, and it's inside the orbit of Mercury, and it's making observations. But the problem is getting the data back. So we can't take loads and loads of images, and we can't take high-resolution images from a spacecraft. And also, the cameras that are on a spacecraft are 15 years old. You know, by the time they get in space, they're old.
Yeah.
And so they're the best you can do from space. So when you're on the ground, you can get the state-of-the-art camera,
right,
put it all together, and try and make observations. So even in 1999, when I was at the Bulgarian eclipse, that was the last big eclipse we saw in Ireland as well, we had cameras that were doing 100 frames per second. No spacecraft could do 100 frames per second. We got data from that one. Actually, the data that we got when we were looking at it afterwards, there was all wobbling going on. We're like, oh, we've solved the solar coronal heating problem. No. Pollen grains above us.
So
there was pollen above us and dust above us, and that was causing what looked like things. So we had a big consortium. We all ended up falling out over the interpretation of the data. So this is the fun of doing
eclipses. It's funny because when you think about, you know, physics and science, you imagine it's all so clear compared to, you know, biology, for example. You imagine that it's really easy to do, you know, you come up with this experiment, you have the technology, you take the photograph, you look at the data, you look at the numbers, 01010, and now we have the conclusion. But actually, it's a lot more messy, a lot more human,
and, you know, it's all the good stuff. But behind the scenes, there's the, instrument's not working, the power turning off, the pollen grains. Actually, then they took the same experiment to Zambia for the eclipse in 2002 or 2003. I wasn't at that one. They took it to Zambia and they put it on a roof of a building at a school. And then just before totality, a lot of school kids came up and started jumping up and down on the roof. And they're like, no, we're looking for oscillations in the solar thing.
Oh,
and all the school kids,
so
they're like, how do we turn around to the kids? They're trying to get the kids down. And they got, you know, 1 minute of data instead of 3 minutes of data because they were chaperoning the kids back then.
Like, but I will say that some of these things are preventable. Like, Peter, like, we're talking about like four failed experiments. And some of these you might just think, you know what? We could have probably thought of that. Like,
yeah,
the power,
yeah,
like a generator would have been probably useful in Guadeloupe, you know, cordoning
off. There was a power generator. So the one in Guadeloupe, there was a power generator. And the problem is you're near a beach in the middle of nowhere and there is no power, but there was a diesel generator there that tripped out.
Okay,
and then we turned everything back on and the computers, by the time they came back on, the eclipse was over.
Oh my God. This is like a comedy. You could write a little comedy.
The failures of my career.
So, what are you going to do different this time?
We're going to get this one right, okay?
You said it here.
We started planning this 1 year ago, right? So we started really early. There's ourselves. There's a guy from Technological University of Dublin as well, Kieran O'Callaghan. He used to work in the Air Corps, and now he's a lecturer. And then Joe McCauley as well from Trinity College Dublin. So those guys are very technical, very good with instrumentation, know the aircraft, know the cameras. And then the cameras that we got are coming from the Italian National Institute for Astrophysics, and they've used it a number of eclipses before.
Right.
So everything should
what
be
could possibly go
what
wrong.
Possible clouds. So I was just looking at the cloud data, and actually I emailed Met Aaron this morning, and I was like, any chance you could tell us where's the best spot to be along the eclipse path? Because we're going to get out there, and then we want to be at 10,000 feet with the window open. But if it's cloudy, we got to go up to 20,000 feet and get above the clouds, but then we have to close the window. So there's a challenge there. But I think our flight path, the cameras, the people on board are all set for this one. I mean, the other variable is the Air Corps could pull the experiment, you know, because they have to go and do something else. Mm. You know, they have important things.
Let's hope
that
Russia doesn't invade on Wednesday. It'd be a good time, though.
Yeah.
Be a really good timing.
Well, we're going to have good cameras. We'll see them on the horizon, so we can give you early warning.
How do you fix the problem from last time? So how do you stop
the vibrations?
It from,
the vibrations.
Because it's the same thing.
Yeah, we knew how to do it actually the last time. We just didn't have enough time to get it all sorted in time. So we've got this, it's called a Ronin gimbal. So they use it making movies. Mm. So if you want to make a movie of a car chasing another car, you get a gimbal that stabilizes your camera and you put it onto the front of your car and you chase it off down the road across cobblestones or whatever. Yeah. So that's what we're using. So we're using a gimbal.
But this is a giant camera though, right? It's a big camera.
The camera is about 500 mils long and it's about 18 kilograms. So it's a heavy enough thing. So it's right on the limit of what the gimbal can do.
Right.
So it's the top of the range gimbal.
But you've tested this.
We have tested. Actually, we did a test flight about 2 months ago. We went and observed the moon and it was stable. So the last one that you and I were on together in, what was it, 2015? March 20th, my birthday.
Yeah, that's right.
It was 2015. The last time we actually didn't have a test flight. We basically had no preparation. So this time we're confident.
Okay.
You've heard it here first.
That's very good. How is solar science in terms of attracting new people to it, right? Because there's so much opportunity now for a young researcher and young scientist to go out. Is solar science a place that that is attracting a lot of young, new talent compared to other areas of research where we're talking a lot about AI at the moment, right? We're talking a lot about medicine and biology.
I mean, AI is really coming into our field for writing papers, for reviewing papers, for analyzing data. You know, I see my postdocs who I'll say, can we plot X versus Y of something of the sun? And, you know, within a day, they have a GUI that allows you to take the transform of the data and do all complicated things to it. So AI is accelerating science. But I think the thing about the students, you know, the cool thing about solar physics is we're working with the European Space Agency, we're working with NASA, we're working with state-of-the-art instrumentation, we're doing cool software, and we're learning about the way the sun works. And there's the basic physics of how the sun works, but it's also how it affects us. You know, it provides the light that's coming in through the window at the moment. It provides the heat that keeps life going on this planet. But also, you know, that the space weather impacts of it, you know, our mobile phones, I want to find a coffee shop. They are affected by what happens on the sun. And you mentioned, you know, the Russians coming over the horizon. You know, if in terms of military stuff, if you want to track things, you want to see things, then you've got to make sure the sun isn't too active. So, you know, there's a whole practical applied side of things that I think is really interesting to students, that you can come in, go off and be a scientist if you want, but there's also loads of practical applications of it. And actually, the vast majority of the PhD students who come in, they're working in tech, finance, AI, you know, that's where they go off because they're good at coding. You know, they're all coders.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you actually, again, because of the European Space Agency thing, there's a lot of talk about Ireland, you know, starting to get into the world of the commerce of space and space exploration and so on. What is that really like? I mean, are we actually at the table in terms of any space science and, you know, in terms of seeing Ireland gain any sort of traction in terms of space exploration or space projects and that sort of thing? Do we talk up the game quite a lot, but are we just really not at the table? I mean, and I know it's important to inspire young researchers and try and build momentum, but actually, where are we in Europe when it comes to space science?
Yeah, it's a growing area for us, is what I would say, but starting at a low base. I mean, the universities, let's just start with the universities and then talk about the companies. But in the universities, when I was a PhD, or when I was an undergraduate in the early 90s, none of them had space science masters or space science degrees or astrophysics degrees. They now all do because they're just seeing students coming in through it. So the universities and their engagement, then their ability to engage with the European Southern Observatory, with the European Space Agency, so on, has taken a step up. And so the faculty being hired and we're producing graduates. So that's a big change, dramatic change in my lifetime. Mm. If you look at the companies started at a low base. So I think 20 years ago, maybe a handful of companies. There was Space Technology Ireland run by Susan McKenna-Lawler from Maynooth University. Mm. And she was building bits and pieces of spacecraft. But nowadays we've got Ubotica, Railtra, and lots of Irish companies. There's over 100 now with contracts with the European Space Agency. So there's small SMEs who are beginning to engage and winning contracts from the European Space Agency. And they're doing, you know, they're doing hardware, they're doing
lasers, you know, sensors. Yeah.
Yeah, but they're also doing things like, you know, smart agriculture. They're looking at how our forests are growing. They're tracking boats coming in. So there's a whole kind of downstream services that Irish companies are getting involved in because we've got the tech background, and the tech background is really interesting. So that kind of gives us kind of good reputation on the street. But there's a long way to go. If you look at France, Germany, United Kingdom, Italy, they have big defence industries, and defence and space go close, go hand in hand. So they build aircraft, they build rockets, bits and pieces of rockets, they build satellites. We are not doing any of that at the moment. I can't say the future is bright and use the word defence in the same sentence. Yeah, yeah. I don't like saying things like
that. No, I'm very happy being out of the defence space.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah, it's not something that I want to see us being strong in. But the space sector and providing good for humanity is something where we can go into, and I think we can make with investment we can grow that industry.
The very best of luck on Wednesday. I hope it all goes well for you, but it'll probably be a good story if it doesn't. Professor Peter Gallagher, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's it on this week's Future Proof. If you are looking at the solar eclipse, I cannot emphasize this enough. Do not look at it with a bare naked eye. In Birr, in County Offaly, at the amazing Birr Castle, there's an event happening where you can get glasses to be able to look safely at the eclipse, and there's going to be talks there as well. So check that out. It's on Wednesday. But anywhere across the country, if there's a clear sky, you might get a chance at this, but don't look directly at the sun. I mean, that should be, if you're listening to this program, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt that you are of a relatively average level of intelligence. Don't do that, okay? Make sure you are protected, and there's lots of ways you can YouTube to look at it safely. Now, there are people in the media, right, in the media landscape who are like Beyonce, and they're one in a million. And then there are people like, you know, the famous people you know from radio, TV, across the media landscape in Ireland. And being in that world allows you lots of opportunities. But even someone like me, who has a level of sort of familiarity for most people in the public of, do I know the guy from school? Like, that's like when I meet people, like, they don't know how they know me. And sometimes the people hear from the radio show, right? But being in the media does allow you, like, I don't want that, right? But what I do love is the fact that this job allows me to do some really cool stuff. And that trip, like, no one else would even be considered to go on that plane, you know, on an Air Corps plane, fly 3 hours off the coast of Ireland, open up a window and start taking photographs of a once-in-a-lifetime solar eclipse. You know, the next solar eclipse is going to hit Ireland is, what, 70 years from now. That was really, really cool. Like, that was a real personal work and life experience. That was an absolute highlight. And I'm so grateful to be able to do those sort of things, you know. And that was such a cool thing to do. You would have loved it. And we did not have two seats, unfortunately, which is often the case. And I think of poor Aidan, right? So Aidan, our producer, he's often putting these things together and so on. But we have a very cool thing coming up.
Yes, we do.
Which is a very exciting. So we're going to, I'll talk a little bit around it, right? So we can't talk
about it.
Top
secret.
It is actually top secret. It could be a massive story for the whole island of Ireland. And nobody knows about it except for you and I,
yes,
and a very small amount of people. And we are working on it at the moment. We've done some recording and it all looks really, really exciting and promising. So we have to do some verification because we don't want to jump the shark or jump the gun. What does jump the shark mean?
Jumping the shark is something we often do during silly season. No, it's when you've kind of lost the plot of what you're trying to do as a TV show or, in this case, a radio show.
Oh, and you go away over. Yeah. Because, yeah.
Okay. It actually comes from Happy Days because apparently there was an episode of Happy Days where the Fonz jumps a skateboard over a shark or a surfboard over a shark.
Right.
And it literally happens in the show and people were like, okay, that's a bit far out, even for Happy Days.
Okay. I've heard that phrase so many times, never understood what it means. Yeah, so that's not what we're doing. But I don't want to jump the gun. And also, you know, we're a science program. So if we say, oh, this has happened and it hasn't, that would be embarrassing. So we are doing the responsible thing and holding an embargo and waiting for science to do its thing. But that would be very cool. And I've already done this thing. And when you go, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. Right. On last week's pod, we were talking about AI and consciousness. I kind of feel like it was almost a foolish endeavor, knowing both the guests that we had who could all talk, but also just the enormousness of a question. Like, it's actually, unless you've got a book, right, it's actually a very difficult thing to talk about, you know, and cover completely. We tried to talk about whether or not AI could ever be conscious. And we had an amazing panel. We had Alan Smeaton, we had Charlotte Blees and Kevin Mitchell. And this is a philosopher, a neuroscientist, and an AI researcher. And we tried to tackle it as best as we could, but like we just scratched the surface and we looked at the time. It's like, oh, that's 30 minutes of talking about this one subject. So
it could have been like three episodes. It kind of makes you realize why there isn't a philosophy show on News Talk. It's like you couldn't have it in an hour. Goes on too long.
No, it went on forever. But we asked what you thought of it, about it, and we got lots of comments. One person says, I've listened to many people and many LLMs debate what consciousness or feeling or thinking actually means in relation to AI systems. Nearly always a phrase like AI doesn't experience events the same way humans do, or an AI system never feels like a human does. Why does it have to? If there is now or will ever be a conscious AI system, why does it have to resemble us in any way? I maintain that if it does happen, even the AI won't notice it at first, let alone its human handlers, because it will be something not seen before. And I suppose, you know, we talked about the pitfall of anthropomorphization. But there's the reverse of that, which is sort of expecting consciousness to look like what our consciousness looks like.
Yeah, and it's actually, I was thinking about this when you were talking about it last week. When we think about life outside of planet Earth as well, like intelligent, other civilizations, you have that thing of like, well, actually, we've such a poor grasp on our own intelligence and our own consciousness that, you know, that apocryphal story of like Native Americans not recognizing sailboats because they didn't have them. Now, that is apocryphal. But there is an element of that. You're like, I mean, it could be there and we just wouldn't even recognize it as life because we haven't even got a good concept of consciousness or where life came from. And I suppose that applies to AI, to artificial intelligence, because at any point, whatever point it gets to what we view as intelligent as us, I think that will surprise us. It will be like, it'll already have happened a long time before that, I think, when we go, that is a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It feels like a large problem for where my head is at the moment. I'm trying to get my head around it. I like the idea of consciousness not being human-like, but being a different consciousness that we don't need to be human-like, but is sort of an AI type of consciousness. I can't envisage what that could possibly be like, but I suppose that's the point.
Yeah.
Catherine says, why aim for fake human? Again, similar idea. We have 8 billion real humans. A non-sensory creature of high intelligence makes a creature with many of the features of psychopathy. I doubt if empathy is really possible in silico. In other words, you couldn't really make a genuinely empathetic AI. where it says, oh, I know how you feel in an AI system. Obviously, it doesn't know how we feel. And she says, consciousness has a lot in common with self-awareness. I reckon a machine will need a self-identity first, perhaps a digital location or set of locations assigned to it. And then maybe it could become self-aware. It can then be coded to defend itself. Consciousness is, for it, becomes the accumulation of information to that end of defending itself. I hadn't thought about that, that, you know, if you give it a place and you say, this is you, and everything outside of that is not you, it will then probably want to preserve itself. But that's what, once you start saying, well, it needs to defend itself, then you open up many science fiction books.
Yeah, it was interesting that Kevin Mitchell also said that as well, that lack of having
a physical location.
A physical location was an impediment, as he saw it.
Yeah, and not being in and of the world, to be able to observe the world and see how it interacts with it, yeah. Maybe we have to accept that there are different types of consciousnesses, Catherine. So similar idea. I do think that people are going to become very comfortable with talking to an AI in their home. Have you thought about this near future? I mean, really near, 5 years from now.
Yeah, I would have thought, like, in some ways a little bit of a Luddite, but are people not already doing that? I would say a lot of people probably are already doing that. I don't know, I definitely don't know very many people who aren't using AI at least semi-regularly. As far as I know, I'm the person who uses it the least that I know.
Yeah, but they're using it through the computer, or they're using it like a Google Assistant, which has been crap up until now. What I'm talking about is having a presence in your home that is like a person and that you talk to like a person. I wonder, have people fully understood that that is both technically possible and extremely likely in the next couple of years? And what that will be like to live in a future where people will say, do you remember when you didn't have a home that was a person in your family? And I do think that that's how people will see their homes. And I'm trying to build that at the moment, actually. I'm looking at the hardware spec to actually build something where I will say, home, what have we got on today? And it will do this, and it will think about all the things I need to do. And if I say, oh, book a table at Chinatown tonight, it will just do all that, and I don't need to think about it, and I'll be able to do that. And just the stuff that where I'm like, oh, I've got to go, what's the name of the website again? What's this? It just knows, because it knows me really well, and that is all private, and the stuff about me is all fully private, and no one can get to it. Although I have probably a more lax attitude to, you know, to privacy than many. I'm not that much to hide, I suppose. But I really welcome that level of lack of friction for those sort of things. I get quite stressed as a parent of, you know, kids and trying to manage all these things. To be able to just speak a command to something and get it done when it's admin, logging onto a website, clicking on a button, putting in a credit card, all that sort of shit. Like, to have a presence in the home where you say, home, do X, Y, and Z, and it just does that, and you know it's done it correctly, and then you get a ping, and you can see the receipt of what it is you paid for and who you paid for, and those things are easily undoable if you've made a mistake. That is so soon, and I wonder how people will feel about it, because to me, it'll be like, you've had a mobile phone all your life. For many people, they have not known what having an adult phone as an adult is like. This would be the same thing. You will be like, oh God, do you remember when you didn't have a home that you could speak to? And I think people haven't realized that is a big thing, that a home that knows everything about you as a person in your home that has a inverted commas personality that you will set in a certain way, like, that is imminent, and it will be everywhere, Aidan.
Yeah, there's a leap though from the tool aspect of it, which makes perfect sense, exactly how you described it there. I guess the unknowable question at the moment is, will people engage in that in an emotional, like you 100%. Said, he's a member of the family. I don't know. 100%. I think a lot of people will just be like, it's just simply how they engage with their Alexa. Do the yoke. Alexa, do the yoke. Like, just, it's just telling some, but it's an inanimate object that they don't care about.
That's because the tasks, you have, at the moment, you speak to Alexa or Google, you have to be very clear. It has a very specific task, because it's really bad at doing things. But when you can have a frictionless free thing and built into a particular service is, have you thought about this first? Conversation will naturally flow from having this thing in your home. And because these things will be so natural sounding and conversational, we will start talking to them in a way that we don't talk to our Google assistants. I think it's going to be wild to think about now, and then things would be wild in 10 years to think about what life was like before we were able to just speak to devices in the way I think we will.
I think you're right about that, but there definitely, I'd say there will be a large cohort who will, because you said you can model it yourself, given its personality. So if you take two different examples of this from sci-fi, you've got a, I think it's called TARS in Interstellar.
Yeah.
The one with the, and they're like, they're moving, like the joke and is that they're moving up and down his humor level because he's like, his humor is too dark and they're in a life and death situation. And, but there you have that bit of personality and it helps them engage with it to say the computer in Star Trek, which is totally functional. But I think there is a lot of people
just want the computer.
Who would be like, not only do they just want the computer from Star Trek, they would be freaked out if it had a personality. So they'd rather just go, you know, computer, what's the story with, like, what do I need to get in the shop today? And they want it to be like deadpan, no emotion, no humor, no nothing. And then obviously you said there will be people who'll pick it to kind of adjust to them and sound like a real person. But I think there's enough people in society who don't like the idea enough that, yeah, they'll use the tool, but they'll be like, I don't want to engage with this personality.
Yeah. I don't think so.
It's hard to know.
Yeah, I mean, in the way that we you know, we don't just wear functional clothes. I mean, I think in the same way we won't want our home just to be functional. We want it to express a certain part of our personality. I think it'd be really interesting. Yeah, like, you might walk into someone's home and someone's home is a dick. Genuinely, that could be. And they love it because it's funny. But like, you're like, oh my God, not this home again. Oh, we got to go to this. Oh, is this home going to be there? Can we ask him to switch his home off? Yeah. Because it's so, like, it's really rude. We're trying to have dinner. Yeah. Like, honestly, I do. That sounds mad. I think that is.
That is very funny.
That's a platform. I mean, make a good movie.
Could make a good movie, yes.
All right, that's it from us in this week's episode. What would you do, by the way? You can email us, science@newstalk.com, WhatsApp us, 087-1400-106, but put in the WhatsApp, put in Future Proof, otherwise we'll never find it. Because I don't know when you're listening to this. Thanks to Aidan McCovey for producing, Rory Galvin for podcasting, and Stephen McLoone for sounding. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.